This large circle, periphery here, represents your skin surface. The one in the middle represents the unassailable, impregnable, imminent spirit. The power there is so great, no stimulus from outside can enter into it. That center of isness is the permanent guarantee of ultimate salvation from the fallen state of an identified being in this zone, which we call the zone of action. A stimulus comes to a new baby, and the baby's consciousness runs out from center to meet it and makes a record, and that is the name in that manner. Now you all recognize this diagram, we've done it very often. When the name is repeated and repeated many times, every time a stimulus comes, it reverberates the name so that any new stimulus coming to it, plus its response from center, makes another record. Like Johnny is a good boy, Johnny is a bad boy, Johnny goes to school, Johnny goes to bed, Johnny plays with illegitimate things, Johnny obeys, Johnny has a grandmother, and so on. All these wonderful things gradually, plus their responses, fill up this zone of existential being in this manner. Now you can see from this diagram that if we go on filling this zone up in this manner all the way round by stimulating it from different points, we shall have a blocked being, a being that will mechanically respond to stimuli. We will go on adding further ones, we'll go on doing this, and this now becomes a drawing of your brain, in which half of it is filled up with records of stimulus situations from all round. I'll put the nose of the person there, and an ear on there, and another one here. That's a person seen from above now. This left side of the brain is full of the records of stimuli, and central to them, the originating one, was the name conferred upon the child. And the whole of this part of the being is blocked. Now the central being does not wish to block itself totally, so it forces all the data into this left side. It wants to keep the right side free for intelligent new discoveries. So when there threatens to be too much of this stuff, and the person threatens to mechanize and become in fact dead, that is to say inert, a message is sent forth from center to set up a special center marked with an Andrew cross, meaning a rebellious man. And this one attacks the system of conditionings. Everybody has experienced at some point in childhood of a tendency to kick mummy on the shins during a period of severe discipline. So the rebellious one is fed from inside to curb this lot. Then occurs a period of identification in which the consciousness in the empirical zone here identifies with this rebellious one and decides to smash society. That's usually mother's vase or something. In this decision to smash is an interesting error, because you cannot smash this without destroying your temporal capacity for relating to socialized beings. All this has to do with socialization. And if you try to smash it and succeed, you would reduce yourself to a simple, plain sensorium with no social inhibitions whatever. So they'd have to lock you up. So when you attack it very strongly, you fail, because the same one that's persuading you to attack it is also feeding its energy into the other elements, to hit back at the attacker. Then comes another phase. The attacker becomes depressed because he cannot defeat society. So he says, all right, we'll have another message over here. And this one, I will draw a flower in this one. That's flower power. I want to draw this in green, really. That's the dropout. That's the one that says, well, I can't destroy them, so I will have nothing to do with them. Now, there's a very interesting thing about this dropout, as we shall see in a moment. The socially conditioned ones, rotating in relation to the primary name given to the child, they're all mutually supporting because they are self-defensive. And the attacking one is wasting its energy against them because it can't win. So the attacking one is so busy attacking and sulking and kicking, it has no time to think of anything else other than a rotten society and its own revolt against it. But in the case of the flower power or dropout person, meaning dropping out of the social system, that one is not spending its time attacking society, it's moving out and moving away from society. It goes into the green belt. It wanders about. It goes to Stonehenge in midsummer. It goes to Findhorn. It goes anywhere. It goes into the desert. It'll find somewhere where human society is not. And when it gets there, it finds an awful lot of dropouts all gathering together. Now, the magnificent menhirs and other monuments of the ancient world. But it has a peculiar virtue that whereas the revolting character, in both senses of the word, whereas that revolting character is busy destroying society unsuccessfully, he is not. He's on the lookout for something terribly important, far more important than anything else. Somehow he's going to find salvation. And through the ear comes the stimulus, and the stimulus says it is possible that there could be a messianic figure, a saviour. And immediately the dropout, with all his friends, moved towards the saviour. Now, if the saviour is a real saviour, he's going to tell you something you don't want to hear if you're a dropout. He's going to tell you to go back into the body of society and learn to assimilate it. Now, this messianic idea, I put the George cross on that, because it's not going to revolt, it's going to say, adjust yourself in your situation, in society. Like we said, para, Brahman, beyond, and then para, para, beyond, beyondness, you're still an incarnate being in the body of human society. And when the dropout hears this, he doesn't like it, because it says, go back into the place that you've gone away from, and steel yourself to assimilate the socio-political economic conditions which have driven you out in the first place. So it feels very uneasy about this advice and would much rather meditate on a high mountain top in nice weather, preferably, than go into the city and be killed with carbon monoxide and lead. So it tends to think there must be another kind of Messiah somewhere else. One that can teach you how to levitate for $4,000. They're quite useful. If you've got the $4,000, you can learn that you still don't float when you've paid. Now, this is only an idea of the Messiah, but it's a true idea. It's the idea of the Logos, the idea of the being that comprehends and assimilates all there is to be assimilated. Which means that it's going to say to the critic, the revolutionary fellow, try to destroy it if you like, but you never will. The destructive intention is good for it because it's critical, but don't think you can ever win. And I want you to find out and criticize only those things worthy of criticism. And for that you have to go back into society, like Neil Kinnock and other great critics, and get on with your work of reforming the social situation from within. Significant that it's Welshmen that usually do this reformation of the British Parliament. And The Messiah is saying to the dropout, don't drop out, go back in, and you will have what is called your daily cross. Everybody you meet will crucify you in one way or another by making you peel potatoes or wash dishes or even straighten your tie. And if you don't like it, you can never make this idea of the messianic figure congruent with this isness. Now somehow that idea of a messianic figure is simply the prevision of yourself, which is hidden in the innermost center of your being, and it has to be moved progressively like this till it becomes congruent with that isness center. Now, if it were not attacked by the mob and by the critic and by the dropout, if it were not attacked, then the whole being would believe that it had become itself the Messiah, that it would not be congruent with the innermost center of power. It would simply be an idea from outside, accepted. I don't know if you met any of these people who are saved, people who are actually saved already. I heard an interview, I think it was last Sunday morning, where a woman who had led a good life, in quotes, she said that, I've led a good life, in quotes, and I have a good husband, a good home, good car, good house, good children, and I have always behaved in this good manner, as God required me, and then I became ill. And when I became ill, I became very annoyed, so I went to church and cursed God and shouted at him, and said, why am I, who is, in quotes, good all my life, why am I now degenerating into illness? And I shouted at God for 1 hour, at the end of which time I suddenly felt calm. Now her analysis wasn't really good. She felt calm, and she attributed this calmness to some kind of divine influx into her, instead of running out of energy of cursing God. Because it is the fact that if you bother to curse your creator, that is yourself in your innermost center, you will run out of energy, and then you will begin to see automatically the error of your ways. Now we have to make this idea of the messianic possibility there congruent with the innermost center, and it must be against this triple resistance of the mob, of the revolutionary, and of the dropout. And for access we'll put in a Pilate and a Caiaphas and a Herod and a Judas and whatever you like to put, who have dictated to the mob anyway. And unless we have this opposition and push towards center against resistance, we cannot become that messianic reality. The savior of our being is already ourself, that Atman in the other diagram. That Savior is already ourself in the middle of our being. That's called Emmanuel, Christ within, the divinity within, the innermost center of aware power. That is the one that posited the circle in the first place. That is the one that has put it through its paces deliberately to consolidate itself. Now why does it need consolidation? Well, let's take it all away. What have we got on the screen? Light. Now light symbolizes consciousness, but in itself without an object. What is consciousness like without an object? Is it of any interest? If you have an infinite field of sentient power, self-luminous, self-radiant, self-what? Has it any utility to itself if it's merely an infinite ocean of absolute shot-throughness of light, understanding, comprehension, etc., etc.? What use is it to itself? Has it any? No. Now that field of light there is when we enter, when we die, and for a shortly after death, for a short time, we find ourselves in that infinite field of light. And ordinarily, we don't like it. The reason we don't like it is because we have interests, we have patterns of behavior that we like to develop, we have scientific investigation intentions, or if we are ladies, we have what is called intention to make worthwhile relationship. We've always got something there, so that when we come into this light, which is the most intense light and perfectly balanced and brighter than any light that could possibly appear in the time process, that light shines right through our presuppositions. It shines through our concepts, and they fade away and vanish. They're there, but they're outshone. If you get a piece of paper and shine a light onto the paper, and then you get another spotlight and shine that light into that light, and then that light into that light, and that light into another light, until your paper is covered in spotlights. Is it not true that all the illumination of all those separate lights is there on the paper, and yet what you see is a bright piece of paper? And yet if you take them out one at a time, are they not giving you evidence that they were there, hidden in the light? Now that light is called the light that never was on land or sea. That means it never was in land, that means formulated clearly, or on sea, that means in an emotionally urgent condition. You cannot get that light if you're emotionally urgent. You can't get that light if you are clearly defined intellectually, empirically. Intellectual ideas and emotionality block you from that light. But if you get that light, you have absolute wisdom and no use for it. That's why the sages say, finally, I'm no use. It's like a loud saying in the Tao, I am the most impoverished of beings. I'm so sage, everything is useless. And that is the condition of that light. And it's because that light was in that condition that it permitted creation, that is closure. Now we're going to do number one, closure. The intention comes from infinity, and that is the zone of closure, cosmic egg. And that allows us to make an island. And the island, we're going to mark it, I'll put a triangle in it to remind us. I'll put a yod, and a hey, and a vav. I put the triangle to remind you that inside that egg there is a triplicity of power aspects. Form, that's the yod, feeling, hey, the life, and conation or drive, the vav. Yod, hey, vav. And that egg was laid by a large hen. That's the hey. And that little hey inside the egg there, and this big hey, are qualitatively identical. That means at your feeling level, you can actually contact, if you will stop rummaging about looking for things, and just expose yourself to the field of awareness without private purpose, then the inner hay or life field there, and the infinite hay beyond that life field, are non-different. That's the origin of the doctrine of Shankara, of non-dualism. The hay or life within and the hay transcendent, infinite without, are not different. And if the hay inside is not disturbed, it can feel the intention of the hay outside. Now that little egg we made there, we can call it the island. We call it the island of the tonal, the island of the civilized being, the island of the existential being in the time matter process. And the hay outside is said to be hay in ex hyo. Hay in that non-state, beyond the state of being bound. That big hay there represents life eternal, life infinite, source of all lives which appear in eggs. And the hay outside the island is called Hay in Exile, and the Hay inside the island we experience most obviously in our breathing. So that letter Hay, the fifth letter, signifies the energy that causes us to breathe. Not the oxygen that we take in or the stuff we let out, but the energy that makes our lungs expand and contract. So that this little hole here is called a window, and that is a drawing of a kind of corner of a house, the wall, end elevation, and this is the window. The breathing hole, the wind hole. So the letter is said to mean a window, but it really means capacity for breathing. Now we take into the egg and we take out from the egg. The inside and the outside of the egg interchange. The chicken in the egg breathes. The shell is porous. If we were to lacquer the shell and make it airtight, it would kill the chicken inside. There is a relation of the inner bound life and the outer life. It's a relation of exchange. Now in the egotistical being, we forget that big hay, and we have a person who in the time process, we diagram like this, now you recognize there the principle of the head, the chest and the tummy, a very archaic form found in Hebrew documents for that letter Hey, the letter which in Hebrew is like that, is like this, meaning the threefold being, where this represents the spine, and that's head, chest, and tongue. Here it is, and this is the word Jehovah, without the terminal letter Hey, which is infinitely extended. And you see here the identity, and the Eve principle, life is going to develop in time. And you go around with legs, and you grab things, and you might reject things, and you rush about with three aspects, ideas, feelings, and conations or drives. And every living being has got this triplicity within it, and in man the triplicity has attained a degree in the highest philosophies and religions, a degree of articulate awareness of its own trinitary structure. If you talk to a frog in the pool down there, it probably will not reply to you other than croak. But if you talk to a human being suffering from even the most rudimentary education, you will get a response in words. The human type somehow has come across a mighty power, the all-powerful word. There is man. I'm going to write that famous mantra we all know. That signifies all there is substantially, the substance of all reality. And then we are going to put the word said to mean a jewel or a diamond, and it means to count down to every individual point until you have totally negated the primordial appetite that precipitated it. Money, a jewel or diamond. Jewel means that Jew is God. And remember, Jew is simply the Yod Hey Vav again. The word Jew means God. The word E-L, spelled with the Hebrew with an A-L, means God as first worker, first precipitator. Whereas the word Jew, where the I is J, and the window is an E, and the Vav or drive is a W, signifies an affirmative living driving power. That was the initiation name of an enlightened human being following enlightenment within the mysteries in ancient Egypt. The Jew meant the mysterious, divinized human being. And to be aware of that fact was to be a true jewel in the crown of the Almighty. Because the infinite power, that supreme light that we mentioned, of itself, with nothing else, has swallowed all its values in an infinite luminescence. So it's obscured itself with its own brightness. So it needs representation, re-presentation. The representation is it appears as a Jew, that is an affirmative, living, driving being. Any being becomes a Jew if he recognizes that he is an ideational, sensitive power being, and says that he is a representative of the infinite in the act of doing what he's doing. Whatever he does, I will make a dot on the paper. I made that dot for God. How did I make it? Well, I made it because I have energy. Where did I get the energy? Well, I had a sandwich. Where did the sandwich get the energy from? From the sun. Where did the sun get it from? Condensation of the solar field. Where did the solar field get it from? From the Brahman. Where did Brahman get it from? Para Brahman. In other words, that dot was written by the absolute power. If you raise a hand, it is God raising it. If God withdrew, that is to say the infinite power withdrew, when you're in the middle of an act, you'd be stuck like a catatonic schizophrenic. You'd be unable to complete your movement. But if the power is there, you can change your mind. You have power to change and to choose from this ultimate source. Now, if you recognize Ma is the principle of appetite, and Ni means the negation of the impulse in the appetite. To make oneself into a jewel, one must go through the world, diamond. One must go through it thoroughly. The word through and thorough are really the same word. Whatever we do, we must do it with tremendous thoroughness. And when we do it with this tremendous thoroughness, we find the minutest detail that we know of is a precipitate of appetite. We never, and nobody ever did, not even God, precipitate anything except by intention of will. When we have done that sufficiently, we are so facile that we can afford to play. If that is jewel there, or diamond, that is lotus, and the lotus means to play. In so far and not otherwise, as we have an absolute finger tip on everything we've ever done, and known, and recorded in our being, so that we can call upon our content of will, in any order whatever, we can play. We can posit the thing. The Padme or lotus means let us play. The Mani means count first to get it right. Can you play McEnroy if you don't know the rules? Can you play chess if you don't know the rules? No, you cannot play unless you know the rules. If you don't know the rules, you're not playing. If you know all the rules, totally, you can relax and play. And that Padme means a foundation or foot of substantial life. Now, substantial life is a game, but it likes counting what it's got. It actually loves the process of enumerating its own content and the content and behavioral systems of other beings. And when it is totally familiar with them, it's no longer worrying. You know what response to do in any situation. When you have counted all properly, this OM converts into HUM. Because now there's a hierarchy within it. The H there signifies the hierarchy. Before this process of dual lotus or counting play, there is a whole substance of reality not analyzed, not controllable, not enjoyable, but oppressing. When a baby comes into the world, some larger-bodied being grabs the baby, hits it, makes it breathe, stuffs, wadding up its nostrils, swabs its throat, washes it, ties it up, names it. There's all manner of oppressive things because the baby doesn't yet know how to deal with these creatures called parents and doctors and so on. So that reality unanalyzed is a horrible oppression. And as you proceed to count, you grow. You're developing your internal godness, your duality, your affirmative living power. The more you know, the more O-levels, A-levels, BAs failed, MAs succeeded, PhDs and beyond. This is something beyond the beyond of degrees. The final degree is voidity. The final degree is rub it all out and recognize what was meant. You cannot enter the kingdom of heaven, that is the kingdom of balanced power, unless you regain the innocence of the baby before it received its name. Remember, the baby, before it received its name, had a capacity to respond to the stimulus. One doctor a few weeks ago said that babies are not intelligent and don't need their mothers, because if you get a circle of cardboard the size of a human face and put two dots on it and wave it like that, the baby smiles. So it doesn't need its mother. So all you do is put an oval card on the end of the bed with two dots on a spring, and when you go by, you hit it. Now, I think that's a bit biased in the analysis. The reality is that the baby recognized in that form, roughly, a face like mummy's. And not particularly the mummy it's got this time, but mummies at all times, staring at babies and saying, mine, my beloved, my beauty, my intelligent one, my beautiful, intelligent, powerful, desirable one, my one just like me. When the baby is responding to these symbolic cuts of paper or card, it's simply calling on its store of wisdom and thinking, close enough. But if that card doesn't do something useful for that baby, it will stop responding to it. The oppressive nature of that unanalyzed whole reality can only be broken down by enumerating it. And that is the purpose of empirical science. Empirical science has the job of playing Marnie examiner. He's the fellow that cuts the diamond, finds the facets, polishes it, and produces finally a decoration with which you can play. We call it the raising of Cain, because Cain means the intellect, like Abel meant faith. By breaking down analytically, so we know all about our content and therefore about the world, because the world and ourselves are not different. Our content is the world, and the world is our content. We are inside the world of the world, and the world is inside our consciousness. It's very hard to remember that. There's a lot of people in this room. None of them are outside my consciousness. Likewise, each one of you has all the others in the consciousness. And what is this mysterious consciousness? A consciousness that has in it all these bodies, all these functions, all these processes that can be examined, felt, liked, disliked. What is it? It's an infinite field of sentient power. And that infinite field of sentient power, we want a word to represent it. Now, it's usual in certain philosophical schools to call it the self, as opposed to a particularized, formulated idea of a self. So let's examine this word. And that has always been a drawing of a serpent, and that has always been a drawing simply of a sine wave. It is the drawing of a motion of power, not rotating. It is the oldest representation of God in most of the religious systems. A serpent, serpent, means a free thinker, a free self-hanger. And then we have the name of God there. And then we have F. And this means the snake, and that means the phallus. And the phallus, or organ of drive, not to be confused with the appendage that males carry about with them in the physical world, but the power that generated that form is called the phallus, distinguished from the penile appendage. The phallus means the reason, that's the foul, and the play. That's the same exactly as Mani Padme, the jewel and the lotus. And that is to do with our reason or formulative power, where we formulate ourselves, and this loose part has to do with the fact that we can play with ourselves when we are fully formulated. Now the L means God, and the L polarizes towards the F, and the E polarizes towards the S. That is to say, the primordial glyph of God, we'll put it in a Hebrew letter there, like this, that's God, Aleph Lamed, that is the Hebrew spelling of E-L there. That is the primordial infinite power which can bind itself in a creative act. And the L is the binding factor. So when it polarizes towards the F, which is the third letter in that Yod-Heh-Vav, polarizing towards F is polarizing towards generation in time. Genesis means genesis. The earth, G-E, physical body, and the energy pushing through that earth makes the grass grow and the trees grow and the animals and man all grow, because spirit has condensed itself by self-ligaturing, self-binding, in order to push through the bound center. The binding is essential for the experience of the resistance, without which there can be no self-awareness. On the other hand, the E, the life letter, polarizes there towards S, the non-rotator. So the F there, if I draw it in this form, this is the Egyptian of it, that is, you can see the F there, if I just do one of our Fs like that. That is a straight line drawing of that Egyptian hieroglyph. And this means the positive, the energy that is ejaculated or thrown out falls onto a center. And it makes what is called a logos spermaticos. That is a word embodied in protoplasm. So that when men generate those little creatures, each one of them represents a packet of an intelligent assessment of the world, and it has fallen onto a center and become an individuated being and tied itself, ligatured itself, the lambda function, in the act of positing. It has created for itself a projection, a new body with which to identify. So over that side is time, but on this side is eternity. The S that does not rotate. Here the S is rotated. There it is, going round. There is the number 6. And that rotatory band is time, and this non-rotatory undulation is eternity. Now that word self now has a different significance to the kind of meaning you usually use when you say I myself. You don't usually say I myself, meaning the God within has tied me to a body to investigate certain possibilities of time matter, and simultaneously the life of the God within has reminded me of my eternality, my utter indestructibility. There are a lot of people today demonstrating against World War III. They believe this half, but they don't believe that half. They believe that if they get fried with a nuclear weapon, that's the end of them. It isn't. They are eternal beings. The body may be destroyed, but for a brief space of time that's uncomfortable. But then when that's over, the true self, the life everlasting, the non-identified, non-captured life is still there. Which means it's not so very frightening. You have a little discomfort for a time, but then you're still there as an eternal spiritual actuality. But this polarization is essential. There must be a resistance in order to make you conscious of what it is that you are willing to become. It is only by your own will and a willing against the resistance that you build yourself up. A force goes along. If it meets no resistance, it travels eternally. If a resistance is set up like that, that gives you the letter K. The blockage there allows you to be aware that you were moving forwards. And therefore, the enlightened person, instead of avoiding blockages, deliberately sets them up, deliberately creates obstacles in order to overcome them, and investigate the nature of the thing overcome, and in the process investigate one's own nature about one's capacity for positing such obstacles. We learn about ourselves at the very moment that we learn the nature of the resistant object that we ourselves have posited. Now the self splits. We draw it again. That one is masculine, this one is feminine, and this one is God. Now the masculine one has got this representative of the phallic force, and the other one, the feminine, has got the agency for serpentry. This one is the Eve, and this one is the Adam. Now let's consider the nature of the relation man-woman in that diagram. The L function has gone to posit the world of form, and the E, the life function, has gone to transcend the world which is posited. That means to say that man is satisfied when he sees the evidence of his prowess growing up. That's my boy. And when he sees that, he says, aha, I am potent. But the feminine side is saying, wait till it grows up. See if it will really run the business for you. Or will it break through your definition and transcend you? The function of the S, or feminine, is to loosen the concept of the male that has posited what he thinks is a worthwhile form. You know the Greek story about a sculptor who sculpted a very beautiful lady and then fell in love with her. Now it's the function of the female to stop that identification, to see beyond the definition that he makes, to see another aspect of it. So then how do we feel about the human sexual relationship? If we accept this proposition that the male is very busy positing external forms in time and matter, and the female is dedicated to being dissatisfied with what is offered. Can you feel, ladies, that there is a fundamental something in you that makes you dissatisfied with everything you are given? Have you noticed? A man might work very hard for a whole year to buy you an ice lolly. And you look at it and watch it melt in the sun. And you say, can I have something more enduring? Like a diamond made in the form of an ice lolly that will endure longer. And if he gets a diamond, can he give her a hologramic one bigger than the universe? He must transcend. He must see something beyond his latest creation, because at some point that have and that has got to meet again there to attain the divinization. Now that is the concept in the mind of man. That is the chest and that is the tummy. And here is the man himself. We'll put short legs on to show he's not going very far. And he has polarized himself. The divine hermaphrodite, the divine being, has said, I will be a searcher for ideas, and I will be a dissatisfied being for the ideas. I will eat in order to get the energy to supply myself with both these forces. And my ultimate goal is to return to the primordial El, or God, from which we derive. And that is the diagram of the whole process. Now, can we assimilate this in fact? Can we take all feminine criticism? Can the male take the criticism that comes from within himself, inside his own being, his own feminine half? And can, in the female, the logic that is hidden in woman tolerate her own irrationality? Each human being is bipolar and has to come to terms with the other pole. Can we do it with ease? The answer is no, we cannot. Why not? Because of a process a long time ago called the fall. The fall was a fall into contingency. When from the infinite there is a precipitation like that, and there is a setup of a being, and there is another precipitate like this, formation of another kind of being, and another one like this, formation of another kind of being. Each being, in order to enrich the infinite field of sentient power, is formulated uniquely. And providing they don't collide with each other, they develop towards their uniquenesses. But if they do collide, at the point of collision, there is mutual obscuration of form. That means a loss of identity. That is called contingent relationship. Contingent relationship is the cause of all obscurations of thought, of emotion, and physical relation. If we keep very quiet, we can find out whether we've got 6 or 5 or 4 points to our star from within. But if we knock on another being for external witness, we become obscured. We don't know if we are, or we don't know what they are. So therefore we need a distance between each other. Now psychologically that distance is quite simply tolerance. You know, engineers say, if I have a spindle, the end section like that, and I have a binding metal there, and I have oil in between there, then I can rotate the one and the other together, and the oil lubricates it, reduces friction, and allows a proper play. Now, supposing I say, here's the character on this rod, and it has that characteristic, and here is a character of another one, this characteristic, and I put oil in here. Now, the oil can absorb the characteristic motion of the square and the characteristic motion of the triangle without obscuring either the square or the triangle. Now that oil is love. Tolerance is love. The oil that you put in your car, petrol oil, rock oil, that oil is the love life of millions of minute marine animals that died long ago. All the oil that we find in the mineral world, in metals, because metals are very oily, in the plant world, that we can abstract from plants as essential oils, in the animal world, in the human world, all that oil is the chemistry of the love life of that being. And that love life oil is the lubricator of our relations. And there should always be that love between, in the interspace between the beings, so that you don't, in order to comfort somebody, pat them so hard they come up in red wheels. Or you break a bone, like a boxer who married a bride and at the altar gave her his first public salutation and broke five ribs. And that happened a few years ago. And that kind of impulsive insensitivity can make a contingency that destroys the organisms that are supposed to be coming into relation. By means of this mysterious oil, remember, every particle of oil in the universe, in the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, the human, every particle of that oil is love embodied. And it allows a distance so that you don't press somebody physically, contingently, to do something for you. You give them a space and you fill the space with the right feeling. And you're not in a hurry. If you don't push, it happens by that magical power. Because that love is a super field which has the power to absorb the motion of the square and the triangle and to produce a pattern like this in the oil. And you notice when we do this, we have a line that's common, the one on the base of the square and the triangle. That is a point of similarity between two people. And we have a difference. This line doesn't match this one. This line doesn't match that one. That's our difference, which makes the relationship worthwhile. So this mysterious oil, a physical fact, is what it is because of the spiritual intention to allow freedom within relationship. To demand nothing, to push for nothing, but to be ready for everything, open, sensitive, non-compulsive, non-coercive. Notice that word. Well, here is our letter L again. That is the word oil in its proper mantric form. There is a whole being. It has polarized itself. There's the letter I, the dot in the middle. Here is the O. And it has bound itself like this. Now that is a form which you already know in the Chinese form. Which is like that. This form and this are identical. The Egyptian form of the same is that. The Christian form of the same is that. There are many forms of it, but they all have the same origin and exactly the same meaning. The one whole being polarizes itself towards form for clarity, towards feeling for relation between the forms. And it's this mysterious betweenness, betweenness, Now, young couples, when they do what is called falling in love, want to get rid of their twainness. They don't like being two, and they often talk about being only one. They might even say, oh, I wish I were inside you. Meaning not merely physically, sexually, but actually inside, safe as in the other being. And if these two beings were safely inside each other, totally, there would be no twainness. There would also be no conscious relationship, because there would be no differentiating factor. Now, how do we feel if we say to ourselves, there is a whole power? The power has polarized towards form, which is male, towards feeling sensitivity, which is female. And the feeling sensitivity can find the significance of the form, whereas the form without the feeling is totally locked up in itself. And we've done the seven planets in many ways before. We will now do them, starting with Saturn there. We won't bother about the ones beyond Saturn, because they are not individuating influences. The individuating influences start with Saturn. Then comes Jupiter, then Mars, then the Earth, then Venus, then Mercury, and then the Sun. That's the order of the planets. We're not putting the moons in, because if you were to put a moon in, we should put them all in. And Jupiter has moons. Lots of the planets have moons, and we have one. We're not putting ours in the diagram. We're going to put the whole of the diagram in the moon. Phasic changes will occur. And we're going to count 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. In both cases, that Earth there is the reciprocal center of the relation between the three planets outside the Earth and the three planets inside the Earth. Now, the Earth is a certain orbital distance from the Sun, the only orbital distance at which the human being can actually come to be and evolve to its level of perfect reciprocal balancing of pairs of opposites. And its job is to breed beings able to assimilate one trine outside the Earth's orbit, another trine within it. And we're going to examine them. Saturn symbolizes greed, condensation, possessiveness, and the Sun signifies generosity. So hanging on to things oneself and radiating powers outwardly, those are two opposites. The being on Earth, the human being, has to learn how to balance his fundamental greed, which makes him into an existential being, and without which you couldn't be a being. If you didn't eat your own meals, you wouldn't exist. If you didn't have an appetite to eat, you wouldn't exist. And the appetite to self-existence is symbolized by Saturn. But then if you merely had that, you would condense onto a hard point like a black hole. There would be no relationship, and therefore it would be meaningless, lacking the mean, the balance between. Therefore, generosity, symbolized by the Sun, has to permeate the greed. That is, when you eat to be of service with the energy you get from the food. Now, you all know the kind of person called Jupiter type, very large-bodied gentleman, usually successful multimillionaire, and they're very generous to charities. They are built by divine intent to comprehend the process of accumulation of importances, importing, carrying in, like the Saturn function. But in order to become the biggest store, Jupiter as a planet has a big store, of energy. It's the biggest of the bodies of the planets in the system. So there is a fellow who depends on his largess, and down here opposite to him is the mercurial opposite, namely intellectual cleverness. This Jupiter type man comprehends all. He's a funny fellow. In business he's fortunate. Whatever he does turns to success, to wealth, power, everything big comes easy to him, because the will of the Absolute is that he collects those things. And he doesn't bother about minute details. He has secretaries to do that. He himself comprehends all there is. And then there is war, Mars. And that's because any such great man with a possessive instinct to gather together the great wealth that later will be given to charities has to make war on other organizations because of the law of necessary opposition. And the opposite to that is the Venus love. Now the human being on earth is resting on the Sabbath. There are 2 threes and a 6. In this particular diagram, we've stretched it out in the actual order of these solar bodies within the system. The human being has to know how to make war and love simultaneously. You're not allowed to fight the Argentinians in the Falklands except in a friendly way. I'm quite serious about that. If you have an enemy, you must love him. But if you don't, you'll be in trouble. You'll have to be able to draw the war to a close and then come to a settlement that will allow him to subsist and continue as your necessary opposition to keep you alert, alive, awake. And then this large, all-comprehending person, the Jupiter man, must be balanced with the knower of the detail. The Jupiter man knows all. The Mercury man knows each within the all. It is essential not only to grasp the whole plan of the work, but to know the details within the plan. A woman said to me recently that she loved the whole universe, but not the people in it. Well, it's a possibility, but it isn't correct. That's like being Jupiter expansive and not mercurially commercially minded to relate to those beings. And then making war and love must be done about the same purpose, the same goal, the same object. If you love it, you have to fight for it. If it's worth fighting for, it's worth loving the being that opposes you or makes you alert to the possible loss of the loved thing. Now, if you can balance those two trines in an earth body on the earth, and there is nowhere else in the solar system or in the sidereal system where this can be done, then you are divinized. You attain the goal. You know this diagram that we do in the hexam. We start in one circle and we shift the compass. We draw another circle. And then we draw another one. And 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 you'll observe that the one we started with first, which you can call number one, if we come to this from outside and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the circle that began it is now the seventh. That's Sabbath, the Sabbath. That is the one that generated these six, That's like the six planets, and this one in the middle, this six petal lotus, is the earth, which balances the other two trines. And one of the trines is here, where we have the function of the sun there, Mercury there, and Venus there, and then we have Saturn there, and we have Mars here, and Jupiter there. And we've got our 6 days of the week balanced on the seventh one. God rested on the seventh day. But the seventh day was already a concept in the mind of the goal to be attained after the differentiation of the other six. The differentiation of those two trines in that six is a necessity of clarifying the meaning of the Sabbath, the day of rest, the seventh day, taking the Bat part as house, like the Beth in Bethlehem. The house of the seven is where the seven which are here separated up there are here overlapping and producing another seven, the whole, and the six petals made by the interrelations. Now we have a physical body, an emotional body, a mentational body, conceptual body, volitional body, consciousness body, in this space which generated this first circle. We have to think about the first circle as coming into being by the intention of the Absolute. Then we can rest. We rest when we know that this body of food, this anamaya kosha, this body of food is a precipitate of the infinite intention of the Absolute to incarnate itself in the human being. Now, it's a tremendously high ideal, say that the human being, every single individual human being, is a divine being hidden inside a fallen body of time matter. And the function of the time matter process is to discover the divinity within in the presence of resistance especially designed to make that discovery very, very difficult. Because if it is not difficult, it will be a concept, an idea, but not the gross established fact of sentient power, self-determinant. The resistance has to be affirmed, has to be loved. If we take our pet word, joy. Now the J there means affirm, and the Y there means assent to, and the O in the middle means the situation. If we enter a situation, if we assent to going in the situation, then we are to affirm that we have assented. And if we have affirmed that to which we have assented, our psychological state is joy. And of course this is nothing but, again, the J-O, short form of Jehovah, assented to. The word joy means the will of God accepted, where God means infinite, intelligent, sentient power with the purpose of the divinization of the human soul. We have to accept difficulty is the essence of the way of substantialization of spirit. Anything easy will do no good. Every time we do something easily, we are slipping. We are not advancing. Those who are not for me are against me. There is no middle. Without either moving towards that center, or we're being flung out by centrifugal force from the center to have further experiential events which will drive us back to center ultimately. How do we feel about it? Just think, each person in this room is a god sitting on a chair. A god sitting there. How do you realize it? Well, you start with a little thing, bend your finger. Now, if you can bend one finger, you can move your hand. If you can move your hand, you can move your arm. If you move your arm, you can move your body, your head. If you can move any part of your protoplasm, then in principle you can move every part. And the ultimate goal is to be able to move the whole being, because this being is nothing but sentient power, to move the whole being deliberately in any manner whatever to join the cosmic dance of powers, the Shiva dance. How do you feel if you sit there and say, I'm a divine being, I'm a god here incarnate on earth? Is it not written in your scriptures, ye are gods? Now, how far does the behavior or the belief or the feeling feel like a god, think like a god, act like a god? And if not, there is work to be done. And the moment we say that, the mob, that is total ancestry, come against us. And then the rebellious one who wants to destroy comes against us. And the dropout thinks it's too much like work. And the high priests and the police and the army and the navy and the air force are all out to stop you until you're quite certain that you're serious about becoming congruent on center with the imminent center of sentient power. And how do you feel if that is true? Can you feel that it's true? How do you feel if you accept it? Yes, hypothetically. What does it feel like? It's called sitting in Zazen. All you do is just remember. I tend to forget I'm God. Is that funny?
Yeah.
It is. Is it not true though? We tend to forget we are God. And if we do, do we think like God when we forget that we're God? Do we feel like God when we forget we're God? Do we act like God when we forget we're God? We don't. Worship is continual remembrance. Worship is worth shape. The worthwhile shape is the shape of divinity. I always find that when people do this exercise of sitting, just remembering, it's true, I'm God. You wouldn't think so, but it's true. I forget. I don't think like God. I don't feel like God. I don't act like God, but I'm God. I think I'll just rest in that thought a moment. Quakers do it, and then they suddenly come out with a mouthful of prophecy. And they have to have a rule. Don't speak unless it's really urgent. And to make it really urgent to speak, don't be urgent, sit quietly. It's dialectical. If it's urgent, sit on it and wait. Something's got to give. It doesn't have to be you. Now, supposing we accept this hypothetically and experimentally, the place is full of gods. How do you feel? There's gods all around you. Gods to the right of you, gods to the left of you, gods in front of you, gods behind you. And they're all equally gods, qualitatively. What can you say to the god or goddess next to you? Something rude? Good evening, God. Now, if you can remember that, what kind of world is it? Do you get out your intercontinental ballistic missiles and start firing? No. You have no need to do that. somebody's got coal, somebody's got aluminium. You like a bit of that? Well, let's find some persons who don't believe in God to handle the distribution. They will. But we can't expect them all to believe they're God until all the aluminium and all the iron and all the manganese and all the other things have been gathered together by Cainish power and controlled. We've got to have space stations all the way through the solar system and beyond for people to go on for new experiments. Until we've got them, we need Cainish men to invent them. When they exist, these particular bodies might have been abandoned, but the souls that had them will be back, saying, nice space station this one. Alpha Centauri, quite nice. Go for a fortnight, you know. We travel faster than the speed of light in those days. You don't need to fight your way on a hovercraft or a common plane. You just stand like they do in Star Trek. All you get is another kind of lag than jet. You have to get used to it, but you will do. And the more you comprehend the inner divinity that you've got, the more you will comprehend that everyone else has the same. And then you have a level of cooperation that cannot be attained in any other way. Now, during the break, commingle with the gods. See what kind of conversation tends to come up. See if you can tell the same jokes in the same way if you remember that you're God. Can you? It's very hard.